Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello there, and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn, Germany. In today's program, we'll meet Russians who are getting creative with their protests against Vladimir Putin in the run-up to March presidential elections. We'll see why Austrians are unhappy with the number of MPs currently sitting in parliament.
You have to differentiate between quantity and quality. And maybe you could do more with less. What we want really is good quality democracy.
And we go to the UK, which is well known, even infamous, for its drinking culture. But alcohol consumption is also linked to violence, including sexual violence. And when alcohol is involved, conviction rates for rape are shockingly low. All that and more coming up on Inside Europe. We'll start in Russia, a country in the midst of political upheaval ahead of presidential elections in March. Strongman Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, who has led Russia in some form for over a decade, looks set for another term as president. But more and more Russians, who, let's be honest, aren't exactly known for standing up to their leaders, are against Putin's return to power. In December, tens of thousands took to the streets of Moscow to vent their outrage at Putin's United Russia Party. This was the first time such a mass protest had happened in Russia in years, and it came as a shock to the Kremlin. Now, ahead of the next mass protest, scheduled for Saturday, Russians are exploring other ways of expressing their anger, creatively. Jessica Gallagher reports from Moscow.
Thousands of cars, ranging from luxury sedans to old Soviet clunkers, sported balloons and white ribbons in the latest demonstrations against Prime Minister Vladimir Putin and his ruling United Russia Party. Demonstrators claim United Russia won parliamentary elections by ballot stuffing and vote rigging, a charge the party denies. Boris, who didn't want to use his last name, is a pensioner who took part in the protest.
I came to support this protest drive, to support this action for free elections, for free and fair elections, which should be taking place in Russia.
The vehicles clogged traffic for hours on one of Moscow's busiest motorways, the Garden Ring. The roadway has some 16 lanes of traffic at certain points, and it is about 10 miles long. Those who preferred not to drive also walked along the roadway wearing white ribbons to show their solidarity. They also carried signs that read, "Putin out of Russia." Peter Shkumatov is director of the unregistered organization that sponsored the protest, Blue Buckets. The group gained recognition for their past protest drives against traffic rule violations by high-ranking officials who have the infamous blue lights on the top of their cars, allowing them to speed through traffic.
We expect that this huge number of cars that took part in the drive on the Garden Ring will show the authorities that nothing has been forgotten, that there's no such feeling that the parliamentary elections passed and everybody forgot about them. No, nothing has been forgotten.
And apparently Russians haven't forgotten. This is the latest in a string of demonstrations against Putin and his unprecedented run for a third term as president. Over the past 2 months, the country has seen its largest protests since the collapse of the Soviet Union. People say they've had enough of Putin and his strongman authoritarian rule. They say they can't tolerate another 12 years of his reign. And average Russians are using every weapon in their arsenal to speak out. A rock band made up of former Russian paratroopers has gotten in on the action, releasing an anti-Putin song called "Nobody But Us." The tattooed former military men sport berets and military medals as they call Putin a tyrant, saying that he has spat on the soldiers, destroyed the military, and sent the officers packing. In the chorus, the men sing, "We are free paratroopers, and the motherland is with us. You're just a public servant, not a czar of God." A crude music video for the song went viral on YouTube. Band member Vladimir Burmistrov told a Russian TV broadcaster why they're tired of Putin.
We're like all people. We don't want to live in a country where there are lies and no concrete government. It's all lies.
If Putin is elected president, he will be the longest-serving leader since Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. For many Russians, that's a result they want to keep from happening at all costs. So they're raising their voices in every way they can. Jessica Gallagher, Deutsche Welle Radio, Moscow.
We turn now to Austria and political protests of a far different kind. In the face of the debt crisis, European governments are, how should I say, under pressure to save money. Almost every country has more debt than it should have. Well, the Austrian people have come up with a way to tighten the financial belt by getting rid of parliamentarians. They say there are too many MPs sitting around in Vienna doing nothing. And they even claim that having a president is a useless expenditure. But when it comes to having a lot of MPs, Austria is not even close to the extreme. In Greece and Italy, for instance, countries that endanger the very solvency of Europe, there are many more MPs per capita. Maybe Austria is onto something here. Kerry Skyring reports from Vienna.
The Austrian Parliament, in one of its more polite moments. It soon deteriorates. Then there's Britain's House of Commons.
Go down to Buckingham Palace and call that election.
A far more robust and rowdy place. Britain has already decided it has too many politicians. Austrians, in a rare period of austerity, are counting up their own and asking, are there too many? And do they cost too much? The debate was kicked off by veteran politician Erwin Pröll, the governor of Lower Austria. He wants the largely ceremonial post of president abolished and says the work could be done by government ministers taking it in turns, say 1 year each, which is what they do in Switzerland. Mr. Pröll claims it's Austria's states which are setting the austerity agenda.
Although I feel we should reinforce and emphasize that the states are willing to reform, and yes, much more. We are the reform motor and want to keep it moving.
But Austrians like their president. Cynics say that's because he lives in a palace and reminds them of the grandeur of their long-lost empire. In any case, the suggestion of sacking him has not gone down well. But the idea of fewer members of parliament, MPs, is catching on. Melanie Sully, political analyst and vice president of the Institute for Parliamentarianism in Vienna, has published a booklet titled How Many Ministers Does a Country Need? In it, she compares numbers of MPs against population in every EU country. She says that in some countries, it's obvious there are too many.
I think what really there is a case for is looking at the whole system of government, the legislature and parliament, seeing how it relates to one another and seeing how it could be made leaner and perhaps more effective.
Austria's ratio of MPs to population is about average in the EU, at 1 for about every 45,000. Tiny Malta has the most, at 1 for every 5,700. Greece and Hungary also have many more politicians than other countries of a similar size. Italy is discussing doing away with some of its 630 MPs and has calculated how much they cost the taxpayer.
And they came to the rather surprising, or maybe non-surprising, conclusion that they're very well paid. They're getting €11,000 a month, the Italian Member of Parliament. Plus, on top of that, on average about €4,000 in terms of expenses, plus free air travel, plus free train travel.
So not in the bankers' league, but certainly not minor league salaries either. Austrian politicians earn significantly less than their Italian neighbours, and according to the Social Democrat Chancellor, Werner Faymann, they are still willing to countenance cuts. But he said, hands off the president in his palace.
There is a discussion, and many are taking part in it. Us too. How can we save in our own area? But in the discussions in which I am taking part, there is no proposal affecting the federal president or of changing constitutional bodies.
And if there is room for savings, should we be asking, do fewer politicians mean less democracy? Melanie Sully thinks there's an alternative to simply reducing the headcount.
You have to differentiate between quantity and quality. And maybe you could do more with less. And so it doesn't necessarily mean if you have less that there's some problem. You could compensate. But what we want really is good quality democracy. So we want good people going into politics in the first place, who are well qualified and for their area and who are committed to the job and to a profession.
As Austria considers big cuts to public services, there have been numerous protests. like this one by unions against cuts to social welfare. But nobody's protesting cuts affecting the very heart of the country's democratic system, its elected representatives. Melanie Sully says it's because their performance has been less than AAA rated.
So nobody's got an awful lot of sympathy with them when they say, you know, they should reduce the numbers. But the last word lies with the members of parliament. And it's a phrase, but no turkey has ever voted for Christmas. The situation is likely to stay much about the same.
Kerry Skyring, Deutsche Welle Radio, Vienna.
I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Welcome back to Inside Europe. I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. In the UK, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has entered the latest stage in his long battle against extradition to Sweden over rape allegations. This week, he attended a hearing at England's highest court, the Supreme Court. He's been on bail for over a year now, after he was arrested in London in December of 2010. Assange strongly denies the allegations that he raped two women in Sweden, and he insists the sex was consensual. However, the Swedish prosecutor issued a wanted notice for him via the European arrest warrant system. Earlier, I spoke to Catherine Hurd, head of policy at Fair Trials International, to find out more about extradition policy within the EU. I asked her first whether Assange was nearing the end of the road in his battle against extradition.
Well, he has a very limited window of opportunity remaining to him now, which would be an application to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. But it's extremely unusual for that court to interfere in the domestic decisions to extradite under the European framework decision. It essentially has the value of an international treaty, and it's not a very common case at all for the Strasbourg court to interfere in that process.
Given that Sweden and the UK are both EU countries, does this make the coordination of the international arrest easier?
Yeah, the European arrest warrant system certainly made cross-border cooperation between all the EU countries much, much easier. It's a fast-track system, and since it's been in place over the last 8 years, the time it takes for one EU country to get a person extradited to it from another has really, really shortened, and the procedures are much, much simpler now.
What are the consequences of this quote-unquote cooperation between EU nations?
Well, essentially, previous safeguards that used to exist in the system of extradition have been stripped out of the system. So what we used to have was a level of discretion, a role to be played by countries' governments, whereas before, as a requesting state, Sweden, for example, would have had to show a lot of its evidence. The only ground of appeal that Julian Assange is now taking before the English court is whether that form was filled in by the correct individual, so whether it is possible for the extradition request form to be authorized by a prosecutor.
If the process is so easy, what can be done to avoid such injustices that can result from extradition?
Well, Fair Trials International has actually seen a number of cases where the European arrest warrant system has caused unfairness because of its inflexibility. So what we're calling for are some basic amendments to be made to the framework legislation. And the first and perhaps most important one is for a proportionality test to be introduced. And I think this is one which Germany is very keen to see as well, because Germany receives 13,000 arrest warrants every year compared to, say, Austria, which receives 387 by last year's numbers. And the other main change which we're calling for is greater opportunity for courts in the requested country who see the evidence that there may be a human rights infringement if extradition takes place, to give those courts a power to hold the extradition, to say, wait a minute, we need further information and we need some guarantees about how this person will be treated before we say that they will be extradited. And this kind of situation comes up a lot with issues like, what are the prison conditions like where that person is going to be held once they've been extradited whilst they're waiting for their trial? Because we've seen many cases of clients who are sent from the UK, for example, to Hungary. We had a client who was held in really terrible conditions in Hungary for 4 months in a former KGB prison. And he hadn't been found guilty or even charged with an offence.
There's been a lot of media coverage of Assange's bail conditions in the UK. He's been staying at the country mansion of a wealthy supporter in eastern England. How might that change if and when he's extradited to Sweden?
Well, if Julian Assange is extradited to Sweden, the bail situation is very different. It is extremely unusual for a Swedish court to grant bail at all. By contrast, compared to most EU countries, they have a very short wait, a very short period of pre-trial detention before the case comes to trial. So it's on the one hand, it's good that the delay shouldn't normally be too great, as it is in some countries like Italy, for example, or Greece. But on the other hand, he won't have an easy time of it, persuading the courts to give him an equivalent arrangement of house arrest or staying in a hotel or something like that. It's much more difficult for a person in Sweden to get a release pending trial.
Catherine Hurd there, head of policy at Fair Trials International. As the Assange case shows, attitudes towards sexual violence vary widely. But whereas Sweden has the highest number of reported rape cases per head of population in Europe, the UK has the lowest conviction rates. Just 6.5% of rape cases result in convictions in England and Wales. These poor figures can be linked to the UK's drinking culture. Wherever alcohol is involved, the chances that a rapist will be convicted are drastically reduced. And British society, too, seems to have a harsh view of rape victims who've been drinking heavily. Laura Schweiger brings us this report on the sobering truth of alcohol-related rape.
The UK is well known for its lively pubs, as well as for its drinking. The country is the binge-drinking capital of Europe, with 12% of the population admitting they drink seven or more drinks in a single night out. That's more than any other European Union country, according to a European Commission study published last year. But all this drinking is also linked to violence, including sexual violence against women. Betsy Stanko, a criminology professor with the London Metropolitan Police, explains.
If somebody comes to the Metropolitan Police to report a rape, what we found over the last 7 years that we've been tracking these is that it's a consistent finding that one in three of the allegations involve alcohol. Now that's high. That's very high. What we also found was that there were a number of victims that came to the police and didn't quite know what happened because, actually, they were very, very drunk at the time.
Perhaps more alarming than this prevalence of alcohol and sexual violence is the failure rate of rape cases in which the victim was intoxicated. According to Betsy Stanko's research for the London Metropolitan Police, the offender was charged in only 10% of cases involving alcohol last year. One possible reason for this high percentage is the difficulty of collecting evidence from intoxicated victims. Elizabeth Harrison, manager of the Haven Sexual Assault Referral Centre in London, explains why.
The problem is that if someone has been drinking very heavily and they come to the Haven, then they might not be in a position to consent to the examination. because if they are too drunk to know what's going on, then our doctors are not going to be able to perform an intimate examination on them. So we'd need them to sober up before they could come back, and then we could do the examination. And it's all about time frames, and obviously the longer it takes for someone to have an examination, the slight decrease in the possibility of finding medical evidence.
An intoxicated victim's inability to clearly recall events is another thorn in the side of alcohol-related rape cases. But both Stanko and Harrison believe there is a much larger hurdle than patchy testimony or incomplete evidence, and that's society's attitudes and misconceptions about rape. Here in Covent Garden Square, many young pub-goers have mixed feelings about alcohol-related rape, and some are prepared to attribute at least partial blame to the victim if she was drunk at the time.
Well, I wouldn't say that she was responsible for something that happened to her, but, yeah, she could have behaved in a way that could have avoided that situation, sure.
If a man decides to abuse that privilege of meeting her, then it is in no way her fault. It is her fault, though, in a way of jeopardising her safety. Now, through jeopardising her safety, she is opening herself up to the badness that exists in this society.
No, I don't think it's in any way the woman's fault. I definitely think that she's putting herself in a dangerous position, but I don't think that means that she should be in any way obligated. It's not like she's asking for it.
The tendency to blame the victim in rape cases, particularly those involving alcohol, doesn't come as a surprise to Elizabeth Harrison at The Haven.
We did an online survey last year that showed very clearly that 64% of people thought that if you drank so much that you blacked out, it was then partly your fault if you were raped. The laws that we have in this country around sexual offences are very good, and the concern that we have is the way that often members of the jury interpret the evidence that's put before them. Often members of the jury don't fully appreciate that if someone is so drunk they don't know what's going on, then any sex that they have then had has not been with consent. So that means it's rape.
So what's behind society's harsh view of rape victims who have been drinking? According to Betsy Stanko, this attitude stems from a larger misunderstanding of what constitutes a typical rape. In London, for example, 3 out of 4 victims know their attacker.
You're not going to stop people from drinking, but what you need to know is this is how it happens. And I also think the important thing is to break the myth of what people think a real rape is, because rape has serious consequences for the victims, and regardless of whether or not they've been drinking, and to deny the consequences for those who have been drinking, I think is a very, very, very serious mistake.
Catherine Brown at the Institute of Alcohol Studies, a UK research institute and advocacy group, agrees that recognizing and supporting intoxicated rape victims is vital, but she nonetheless emphasizes the importance of women drinking responsibly in the interest of rape prevention.
Would never want to get into the territory of victim blaming, for example. However, I think that we would always want people to be given all of the information available so that they can make their own informed choice if they choose to drink. A lot of the information that we would want to give, especially to young women, is that if you do drink heavy amounts and drink to excess, then you are at a greater risk of vulnerabilities to sexual assaults as well. So I think everybody needs to have an understanding about that, and that certainly doesn't come into any kind of blaming territory.
But lessons in responsible behaviour to avoid rape aren't something that sexual assault centre workers like Elizabeth Harrison say should be our focus.
If somebody's so drunk that they're passing out, if they're so drunk that they're being sick, then they are clearly not in a position to give informed consent to sex. And as a society, that's what we need to be understanding. Most of the focus in this country is around prevention, and that's around women taking responsibility for their safety. And I think it's high time that we put the emphasis where it belongs, which is on the men who are choosing to do this.
For the people out enjoying drinks in this London pub, though, the possibility of rape doesn't seem to be weighing on their minds, at least for now. Laura Schweiger, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
This is Inside Europe, and I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. In the next half hour, we'll go to Istanbul, site of a controversial urban renewal project. The city says it's giving away better housing to the poor, but many of them feel pushed out by property developers. We'll also hear about how the Swiss government is thinking about giving reparations to a group of people who were robbed of their childhood and forced to work as indentured servants.
I think the worst was that nobody ever told them a story, never took them ever in their arms. No love, no nothing.
And we'll visit a school in Bulgaria where kids are hitting the boards as much as they're hitting the books. Chess boards, that is. All that and more coming up in the next 30 minutes of Inside Europe. Let's go first to Romania, where protests over a gold mine project have spread from the small town of Roșiamantana, where it's located, all the way to the capital, Bucharest. This week, Greenpeace activists descended on the Environment Ministry to try to stop the plans for the mine from going ahead. They even stormed Romanian embassies in neighboring countries, calling for help to stop an impending ecological disaster. The project, which aims to use cyanide to extract hundreds of tons of gold, has also divided locals into two opposing camps, those who support it and those who fear it will destroy the area's tourist potential and its ancient archaeological remains. Tom Wilson went to Roșiamantana to hear both sides of the story.
As soon as you enter the village square in Roșiamantana, it's clear that you're entering a divided community. On the left, you have the headquarters of Pro Dreptate, an NGO supporting the mining project. Right opposite stands the Roșiamantana Cultural Foundation. Here I met Sorin Jurca, a fervent opponent of the project, which he says has divided the village in two.
Și din 2001 chiar am văzut cu ochii mei cum au plecat mii de oameni de aici ca să...
Since 2001, I've seen with my own eyes how thousands of people left this place to make room for this disaster that's taking place here. They made real estate deals and left without thinking about the history of the place, their native soil.
140 houses within the prospective mining area have already been destroyed, while many local people have left. In their place are the 500 employees of the Roșiamantana Gold Corporation, dressed in their green and yellow uniforms. One of them is Ion Motoi, who's worked for 6 months for the company. He can't wait for the mine to open.
There is nothing here. It's a dead zone. There's no work, no way to earn a living. Without gold, there's no chance to escape. The region will remain a dead zone. What matters are the jobs that you can have today. I would like the project starts tomorrow if possible. Regardless of how dangerous it might be, having to live in poverty is even more dangerous.
The mine will create around 3,000 jobs and has the backing of the Romanian president, Traian Băsescu. The president of the NGO Pro Roșiamantana, Andrei Jurca, explained the arguments for the project.
When they closed the state mine, there were lots of people who had no way to earn a living. They became unemployed, and more than 85% of the young people from Roșiamantana are unemployed. For more than 2,000 years, they've mined gold in Roșiamantana. The town was born and raised on mining, and it's absolutely necessary that it continue to do so.
Outside the village cafe, Andrei Gruber disagrees. At 26, this son of a miner opened the only guest house in Roșiamantana. Andrei believes the new mine would kill tourism in the area. The project would demand the use of large quantities of cyanide and the construction of a tailings dam where cyanide-contaminated water would be held.
If they carry out the project, they will destroy the four mountains that surround my home. They'll also bury a village in the next valley. It will offer just a few jobs, just for a few people, and will last 15 years, maybe 16, however long the project lasts. And then what? Tourists aren't going to want to come and look at the mine workings.
The mining project still awaits the green light from the Ministry of the Environment. However, Cătălin Hosu, Gold Corporation spokesman, says the mine will bring prosperity and sustainable development.
Toată zona industrială, care include carierele, drumurile industriale, uzina.
This whole industrial zone, which includes the quarries, the industrial roads, the factory, the tailing dam, all of it, is just 12 square kilometers. It's a very compact project. This will be a living, inhabited area, just as it always was. There's also a management plan for the cultural patrimony, allowing for restoration and renovation, and the creation of a tourist route, with investments of $70 million. It's the most ecologic technology available for the extraction of gold and silver.
The project will use between 13 and 15 million kilos of cyanide each year. In 2000, an estimated 100,000 cubic meters of cyanide and metal-laced water spilled from a Romanian gold processing factory in the north of the country, killing aquatic life for miles downstream. Despite such risks, the project looks more certain than ever to go ahead. A law being debated in the Romanian parliament could allow the mining company to begin exploitation. Eugen David, head of the local pressure group Albornoz Maior, says these attempts to fast-track the project are illegal.
We found ourselves facing a law that is not democratic, that is against the Constitution and against EU legislation, that would change the mining law to allow multinational mining companies to expropriate to start operations. The law has unfortunately already been passed by the Senate and will be voted on in the Chamber of Deputies. The final battle will be a bloody one, as each side is sharpening their weapons.
Tom Wilson, Roșia Montană, Deutsche Welle Radio.
We move now to Turkey and another form of distress caused by a different form of development. Istanbul, Turkey's largest city, is booming. Throughout the entire metropolis, where some 13 million people live, authorities are embarking on massive projects to redevelop the city. But these projects mean that thousands of people will have to move, in many cases to make way for high-end apartments and housing complexes. Nowhere is the contrast more stark than in Talabasha, a poor neighborhood in central Istanbul that developers can't wait to refurbish at a tidy profit. Dorian Jones with this report now from Istanbul.
In the Talabasha district in central Istanbul, houses have been destroyed as part of a major redevelopment by the local authority. For the thousands of people living here, most have been evicted, even if they own their own houses, like Mehmet Taş.
My children grew up here. Their friends are here. Their school is here. If I move from here, I will lose my job because I won't be able to pay for my commute.
Taş, like many others in the Talabasha district, has been offered state accommodation 40 kilometers away. The plight of the Talabasha residents has become a focal point of growing concern over the redevelopment of Istanbul. On Sunday, hundreds protested against redevelopment plans in Taksim Square in the center of Istanbul, just a few minutes' walk from Talabasha. Although it occupies a prime central location, Talabasha is still quite rough. Its housing stock is largely dilapidated, but cheap, which makes it one of the only places poor people can afford to live in central Istanbul. The present mass evictions of Talabasha residents have drawn growing criticism, both in Turkey and abroad. Andrew Gardner of the UK-based human rights group Amnesty International recently published a report strongly condemning the project.
Talabasha is a particularly outrageous example of the way urban regeneration is being carried out and results in people being evicted without being consulted on the process, without alternative adequate housing being provided, with harassment frequently by officials against the people who are facing eviction in these areas. Frequently it's the people who most at risk, as in Talabasha, that has included people who are from Roma families, transgender women, people who really find it very difficult to get rented accommodation in the private sector for a number of reasons.
But the local mayor, Misbah Demircan, strongly rejects such criticisms. He says the regeneration project is as much about helping the local residents as the city as a whole.
278 binanın çoğu tescilli yapı.
Most of the 278 buildings we're tearing down are condemned buildings. 3 days ago, a building burnt down because it was so old and dangerous. The buildings are fire hazards, and some even collapse because of heavy rain. The people living there now are living there under risk of death. Neither their lives nor their property are safe. We're offering safe new houses in exchange.
The homes Demircan is referring to are state housing, most of which is located far away on the city outskirts. Critics claim the offer is a poison chalice. Many who do move away lose their jobs because they're unable to afford the commute to work, while others end up unable to afford the rent in public housing. Professor Yves Cabonnet of the Development Planning Unit of University College London says the experience of a previous redevelopment project in the city supports such concerns.
360 were put 60 kilometres away. Do you know how many out of the 360 are still in these stocky blocks? Two. All the others are just roaming over the city. Homeless. The renovation, which is claimed by the government, so it's a minimum. It's about 1 million homes, which is massive. It's a massive project.
Construction projects are speeding ahead throughout the centre of the city, where crews are busy building high-end housing aimed at Istanbul's growing professional classes. Istanbul's city skyline is cut by rising skyscrapers and construction cranes, along with a seemingly unending din of building. But the people of Talabasha and many more of Istanbul's poor are likely to pay a very high price for such redevelopment. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
We turn now to Switzerland, to another story of displacement, one with even more troubling results. A new film and exhibition has come out, documenting a practice that began in the 1800s, under which orphans or children from homes deemed unfit by the state were taken to camps and forced to work as indentured servants. These contract children, or Verdingkinder as they're known in German, reveal a dark part of Swiss history, one that has been repressed until now, even though the practice existed until the 1950s. Imogen Folks with this report on the tradition Switzerland is only now beginning to address and the solace that comes with the state's recognition of their suffering.
In Swiss cinemas, one film has been drawing the crowds for weeks. It's not a Hollywood blockbuster, but a homegrown feature with a horrific subject. It tells a story of exploitation and abuse of children on an institutional scale. And it's not fiction, but fact, as 55-year-old Peter Weber knows all too well.
One morning, when I was four, my mother took me on a train way out into the country, to a farm, and then she said, "You have to stay here now." I think that was the moment I lost my faith in people. I had to work from the start. They hit me almost every day. It was pretty bad.
Peter was what the Swiss call a Verdingkind, or contract child, removed from parents the authorities deemed unfit and sent to work on a farm. It's estimated at least 100,000 Swiss children were Verdingkinder. The practice continued until the 1950s, but there's not much about it in the history books. Peter's friend and neighbour Magda first heard about it from him.
I didn't think that in Switzerland things like that existed, and so I started to investigate this and got to know him, and people start to believe his story, because this is now open. Before, these stories were, they were liars, as simple as that.
These are tools that are mentioned by the Verdingkinder that were used to beat them.
But after decades of silence, the history of the Verdingkinder is finally being told, not just in the feature film, but in an exhibition now touring Switzerland with testimonials from victims.
Some shoes made from wood, as we see over there.
A belt.
A belt, a pan.
And an insight from historian Rudi Weitmann as to why the Swiss authorities treated so many children so brutally.
Up to the 50s, there were regions in Switzerland that were really poor. The Verdinkinder, they were taken from poor families in the cities and given to poor families in the farming. Many of them lived in very bad circumstances. They had very hard labor to do from the age of 5. They were beaten regularly or daily. Some were sexually abused. This here is a letter, for instance.
Many of the contract children came from families the authorities simply didn't approve of, from unmarried mothers or those who were divorced, or even sometimes from a father who liked a beer now and again. The children were taken without their parents' permission, and many never saw them again. Letters and presents sent by desperate mothers were not even given to the children. It went on for decades. Almost every country village had contract children. But it was a taboo, says Rudi Weidmann, that no one really wanted to talk about.
At the core of a taboo, everybody knows, but no one dares to talk about it. The Verdinkinder didn't dare because they were afraid, they were ashamed. People who were responsible for the treatment of the Verdinkinder, they didn't want to talk about it. And maybe one reason why the taboo is breaking now is that the people who were responsible are probably all dead by now.
Peter Weber now lives alone. His most trusted friend is his dog. Denied a proper education, Peter doesn't have a job. Still, he takes comfort from the fact that what happened to him is now, at last, a matter of public record.
Die Kindheit wurde gestohlen, das ist so, also, das stellt dir vor.
My childhood was stolen. Imagine it, someone takes your 4-year-old child and gives it away to strangers. Imagine. It's very important that this is addressed openly. It's not about money. It's that if we are believed and that the government says sorry, that would do us good.
Der Staat sich entschuldigt, das tut gut.
But, as Peter's neighbor Magda points out, some things can never be put right with either words or money.
I think the worst was that nobody ever told them a story, never took them ever in their arms, you know, never a hug. I can't imagine the loneliness. Actually, I'm nearly crying only thinking of it because I've got kids. I think really the working was not the worst. The worst was really the beating. No love, no nothing.
It's believed the Swiss government is now considering some form of apology to the thousands of adults like Peter who were so badly treated as children. It's a start. But since so many former Verdinkinder were denied proper schooling and therefore decent jobs, calls for financial compensation are likely to grow. Imogen Folks, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bern.
I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Welcome back to Inside Europe. I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. We move now to Germany, where grappling with the past is a daily fact of life. Germany puts a great deal of effort into not forgetting the Nazi atrocities committed against the Jews 70 years ago through public memorials, initiatives in schools, official days of remembrance, and more. However, anti-Semitism is more prevalent in society than you might think. At least 1 in 5 Germans harbors some kind of anti-Jewish beliefs, according to a recent study that was commissioned by German Parliament. The study found, though, that these beliefs are not like the anti-Semitism of the 1930s that allowed Nazi ideology to flourish. Back then, anti-Semitic beliefs were expressed publicly. Now they are kept inside, or what researchers call latent anti-Semitism. I had a chance to talk about this study with one of its authors, the historian Peter Longerich. He studies Nazi-era Germany at Royal Holloway University in London, and I began by asking him what latent anti-Semitism is.
Well, latent anti-Semitism is a form of anti-Semitism which doesn't find expression in actions or in public speeches. It's simply a matter of attitudes, of beliefs. And, of course, it's not so easy to, find out how widespread these latent beliefs are. You cannot ask people, on a scale from 1 to 10, how would you assess yourself, your anti-Semitic beliefs. It's a more subtle, there are more subtle methods to measure it. And the surprising thing is that different institutes and agencies who did opinion polls and sociological research in this area always came to the same conclusions over the last years, and that is that the percentage of Germans who share some kind of latent anti-Semitic beliefs is around 20%.
What harm do these beliefs, what harm do they do to German society?
Well, I think the problem is that on the one hand, anti-Semitism is a taboo in Germany. If you express openly anti-Semitic positions, you will actually find negative, very negative reactions. We had a number of scandals in Germany over the last years in which actually careers of politicians found an abrupt end because they used anti-Semitic so-called arguments. But I think the danger is that we have a kind of silent, latent anti-Semitism, so a kind of sleeping anti-Semitism, and there might be a situation in the next years when this latent, silent anti-Semitism might find ways of becoming more open and becoming what we call a manifest anti-Semitism.
How does Germany's problem with anti-Semitism compare with other countries in Europe?
We have actually opinion polls and also sociological research in other countries, and it's clear that the figures, the percentage of people with this kind of latent anti-Semitism is lower in Western European countries. For instance, in Britain, it's significantly lower. It's higher in a number of other European countries, particularly in Poland, in Hungary, and surprisingly also in Spain and in Portugal. So if you compare Germany's situation with other countries, we are somewhere in the middle. But on the other hand, if you look at these the enormous effort which are taking in Germany to actually educate people about the Holocaust, about anti-Semitism in schools. If you look at the efforts of public television, for instance, to educate people in this area, then it's quite depressing that prejudices like this will not vanish. They are obviously a major and important ingredient in our culture still.
What do you think should be done to tackle this problem?
Well, we have actually set up a catalogue of recommendations. We were asked by the German Parliament to compile this report. We are recommending, first of all, more research in this area. We are recommending regular opinion polls, which also would include inquiries about the attitude of people, of migrants, people with a migration background. And then what we would suggest is that the institutions of the state, which normally are responsible for this in this area, police, the judiciary, the educational system, and also huge societal organizations, the German sport organizations and leisure times organizations and others, that they would actually come together and set up something like a round table. Our answer is, if you really want to tackle this problem, you have to develop a comprehensive and a long-term strategy.
That was German historian and Nazism scholar Peter Longerich. If I think back to my school days, one thing that doesn't necessarily spring to mind are all the games of chess I played. For some, sure, chess may have been a major part of life, and I could admit I probably had the pleasure of saying checkmate to a friendly foe now and then. But there's one school in Bulgaria that's gone a step further. It claims to be the first in Europe to have introduced chess as a compulsory subject for all its students. and those behind the project want the idea to be extended across the continent. Deutsche Welle's Joanna Impey went to the school in the Bulgarian capital, Sofia, to learn more.
The sound of kids released from a morning of lessons echoes around the corridors of the Eurostandard High School in central Sofia. But in a classroom on the top floor of the school, 14 pupils are getting ready for their next class. They're laying out chess sets. Two keen 17-year-olds are already well stuck into a game.
I'm Christian.
And I'm Stefan.
And I'm really good, and I own him.
And he's losing at the moment.
I let him win one game, and then the next two are mine.
Yes. We start pulling legs.
So there's
now
a competitive spirit going on here.
This is not an after-school chess club. It's a formal lesson. When the teacher arrives, the class quietens down, and all eyes turn towards the front of the room. There's a large poster of a chess set pinned to the wall. The teacher points to the different pieces, focusing on strategy. The lesson is in Bulgarian, but another teacher translates for me.
One of the boys suggested the horse to go ahead, to be the active figure. Then another one suggested the queen. And the teacher is explaining why it's not a good idea the queen to move ahead. Because if they do this, the queen could be very easily attacked. And so it's not good for the further development of the game. And if they follow this strategy, there will be several moves, no more than 3-4, and there will be mate.
Stefan and Christian have differing opinions about the new subject on the curriculum.
I like it as an idea in school because chess is developing the thinking skills and your mental condition, let's say. And it's great to play in school. It's refreshing and it's something new.
First of all, it's a great idea because it exercises your brain, but I don't like it, personally. Like, it's for entertainment, but one day a week, maybe.
For now, the pupils do play just once a week. And in Bulgaria, they're the lucky ones. This is a private high school, which specialises in preparing elite pupils for careers in banking, finance and insurance. There are just 50 pupils, aged from 14 to 18. Bojko Hristov from the European Chess Union, which helped set up the project, hopes that this school will be the first of many. Hristov told me that chess is an important tool for developing strategic thinking, logic and concentration skills.
Of course, the main idea of this program is promotion. Not advertising of chess, but promotion of chess. I want to stress on this difference because promotion of chess, because we care about our children of the new generation in Europe. So, of course, we want to give them the best. That's why we need to promote chess. That's why our partnership became a reality. Of course, Bulgarian state have to find money to promote chess in all schools, but the main idea is this.
And their ambitions don't stop there. Their ultimate aim is to give young people across Europe access to chess. In September, the European Chess Union presented their programme for chess in schools to the European Parliament. Apparently, it was received with great interest. So who knows where this might lead?
It's my turn.
Back in the Eurostandard High School, Christian and Stefan are still focused on their game, even though the class is nearly over. Christian is confident.
Come in 20 minutes if you see me win.
It looks like those two might have to stay behind to finish that game off. Joanna Impey, Deutsche Welle Radio, Sofia.
And that's all we've got for this week's edition of Inside Europe. If you want to drop us a line, we're always very happy to receive listeners' feedback. Our email address is europe@dw-world.de. On behalf of my production colleague Matt Herman and sound engineer Angelique Müller, thanks for listening. And it's goodbye from me, Gabriel Borud. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn.